It is Sunday, May 19th, 2013, and this is episode 19 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, the thoughts and opinions and stories that I talk about on this podcast do not represent those of my employer and really only represent my thoughts and opinions. So I hope everyone has had a good week. It's been another interesting week for me. Today was a particularly challenging day. We had some pretty significant thunderstorms here. And in my backyard, I've got some really tall pine trees, and two of them decided to fall down. I'd say one was pretty close to 100 feet tall, and it stopped. It ended up just about 5 feet from the back of my house, so that was a really close call. I spent the majority of the afternoon with spending some quality time with a chainsaw and hauling a couple thousand pounds of wood over to the other side of the yard. There is something to be said for great neighbors. Behind me are a relatively recent addition to our neighborhood. I think they moved in last year. The guy that lives in the house heard my chainsaw and came around his fence with his chainsaw, and he spent probably close to 3 hours with me cutting up trees. So sometimes my faith in humanity gets restored. The next thing I want to mention is that I'm uncertain whether there'll be a podcast next week or not. This is the final week of school for my kids, and we're going to have some fun for the next week or so. I'm taking some time off of work, and I'm not really sure what we'll be doing or where we'll be at. But if I can find a way to get one in, I certainly will. If you're stuck and really going through withdrawal, might I recommend the TrustWave Spider Labs radio? That's actually a really pretty good podcast. I really enjoy listening to it. It has interesting news and not a lot of fluff. And no, I'm not affiliated with that podcast or that company in any way. All right, so let's jump into stories. The first story is what I am drinking. And you probably guessed that it has something to do with lemonade. And today it's just a straight up Mike's Hard Lemonade. My ears, my back, and my head are killing me from working with the chainsaw all day. So I went the uncomplicated route. All right, next story is this past week was Microsoft Tuesday. Microsoft released its normal cadre of patches, one of which was a fix for the IE8 vulnerability that was actively being exploited. Personally, I don't find Microsoft Tuesday all that exciting anymore. It's gotten to be kind of monotonous for a lot of people. It's still obviously extremely important. One thing that is interesting is that Adobe now releases their patches on the same schedule that Microsoft does. And this past Tuesday, Adobe released fixes for Reader, Flash Player, and ColdFusion. Now, if you listen at all to Risky Business, which I highly recommend you do, it's an excellent podcast. Patrick Gray is a great host, far better than I'll ever be. Adobe is a sponsor of theirs, and Brad Arkin, who is their CSO, I believe, head of product security, has spent a lot of time describing what Adobe has done to improve the quality and security of their products. And, you know, it's actually pretty commendable, but I think I'm still really very concerned. There were, for instance, 24 remotely exploitable bugs in PDF Reader and Acrobat. there were 13 vulnerabilities in Flash Player, although it doesn't seem like these were known to be exploited out in the wild. And I think we all know about the Cold Fusion bug. So if you have Cold Fusion banging around on any servers of yours, get it updated. Also, it should go without saying, but if you have an enterprise where you deploy or allow PDF Reader or Flash Player to be installed, it is imperative that you have a centralized mechanism to update these things. I see case after case after case where organizations do not update these pieces of software. They don't have a strategy to update them, and they just languish. Now, I know that the later versions of Reader, and I believe Flash Player too, have auto-update mechanisms built in. I've actually seen quite a few instances where the version installed on workstations predates that auto-update functionality. Plus, we don't really want users of workstations to be in control of when and if really critical patches get applied. All right, next story. Jacob Applebaum was at the Oslo Freedom Forum and happened upon a Mac belonging to an African activist. There aren't a lot of details that lead us to understand why Jacob actually looked at this computer in this way, but he did, and what he found was some malware that was signed by a valid Apple developer certificate. My suspicion is that the conference organizers were looking at network traffic, and they probably saw some traffic from this person's workstation, his Mac, to a known CNC IP address. But that is purely speculation. Anyway, this story isn't particularly novel, except that it highlights the recent trend in malware actually passing itself off as legitimate by being signed with a legitimate certificate. Hopefully, it's becoming apparent that from a security standpoint, we can't trust certificates, and the fact that a piece of software is signed be a determining factor of whether or not we consider something suspicious or not. Certificates can leak out in many, many different ways. We've seen it happen lots of different ways over the past few years. Hopefully, in the future, we can come up with some better way of establishing the reputation of a piece of software through some other mechanism than just being signed with vanilla certificates. Okay, the next story is that the EC Council had their website hacked. I am sure everyone knows that EC Council is the organization that runs the Certified Ethical Hacker certification. In this particular case, the hack is almost entirely uninteresting, except for two things. Number one is, well, it's the EC Council who runs the Certified Ethical Hacker program. And the other is that the attack apparently took advantage of some really, really old Joomla code, like 2010 old. And in case I didn't say it enough, that's really, really old. What this highlights for me is a problem I've seen as I ran IT operations a long time ago, and that is that things get orphaned. Applications get set up and built by smart people who have the time and talent and creativity to come up with something interesting, and they move on to a new role or to a new company, and the application just kind of languishes. I have no particular insight into what happened at EC Council, but I can only assume that it probably aligns with things I've seen in the past. The application was set up, some modules were added, the template was tweaked, the person who set it up moved on, and it became very complicated or not a priority or whatever to update it, and it just fell off the radar screen. And what's unique about this one, I think, is that it highlights that this sort of problem exists even in an organization whose sole purpose is security awareness. Whether it's PHP and WordPress and Joomla or ColdFusion, these things have bugs all the time. And if you don't stay on top of them, you're going to get compromised. It is just a fact of life. What really surprises me is that they weren't compromised a long, long time ago, and heck, maybe they were. To me, taking on a website like that, or really any application, whether it's internal or external, is kind of like adopting a kid. It is a commitment that you're making. You can't just buy it, set it up, put it into the closet, and forget about it, because it's just going to become a nightmare that will come back around and bite you in the rear end. Knowing where your applications are, what they are, who owns them, whether they're being patched is a really critical control. And by the way, I'm not dogging on EC Council. They just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time with this one. This sort of problem happens all the time to all different sorts of companies. And I can only assume that they have been putting all of their effort into developing their fine courseware rather than updating their website. So there's a link to an article on HelpNet Security that has a little more information about some web shells and some other details that were found when they took a look at the EC Council site. The next story is an article on Network World about the 7 steps to securing Java. And I apologize, if you click on the link, it's going to ask you to become an insider. Nothing I can do about it. I've been a somewhat outspoken critic of Java, so this should be interesting. Step number 1, perform an impact analysis. That means determine all of the valid uses your employees have for Java. Step number 2, keep Java updated and patched at all times. Apparently, this is going to get a little more difficult now that Oracle has decided to change the way they number Java updates. However, security people are pretty smart, and I'm hopeful that we can all figure it out. Now, one interesting piece of advice under keeping Java updated at all times is something that I actually hadn't considered much, and that is before you install the new version of Java, go and uninstall the old version of Java to make sure you fully remove all of the cruft that might be hanging around. Now, they also go on to say to consider limiting the use of Java-based apps to virtual machines that can be started up when needed and otherwise left powered off. This is something I think we've talked about in the past. Certainly one of our listeners wrote in and described that they actually do this in their environment. They have a virtual desktop infrastructure or desktop cloud, however you want to describe it, whose purpose exists to deliver Java functionality to their clients internally. So that population of virtual workstations doesn't have access to the internet. There's a firewall in between, and Java can only get to internal applications. And that's a really good design. I suspect you can actually do something similar on the workstation itself using VMware or virtual PC or VirtualBox or one of the many hypervisors. Although doing it that way probably presents a little more of a challenge in how you restrict access to outside websites. Okay, step number three, manage Java control panel settings. There probably isn't a ton to do here anymore. One of the major things that has happened recently is that recent versions of Java 7 now have their security settings set to high as a default. And high means that only signed applets will run. However, we all know that malware is increasingly being signed. So that's not really a great protection anymore. And even running unsigned Java just prompts the user if they want, whether or not they want to continue. And most people have been trained to always click yes or accept or continue, generally because they want to get to their pictures of funny cats or videos of monkeys throwing poop at each other. Okay, number four, harden web browsers. And I guess by harden web browsers, what they really mean is disable Java in web browsers. And there's a couple of things you can do. One is you can stand up a proxy server in your environment and not allow Java content through the proxy, although that's not necessarily very viable in lots of environments. Another is to have two different browsers that are commonly used. Let's say Firefox has Java enabled and Chrome has Java disabled. The one problem I see with that is, I understand it at least the last couple times I've tried, each time a Java update comes out, all that stuff gets reset. The browser plugins get reinstalled. The ask toolbar gets reinstalled and all that. But, you know, realistically, I think this might be a good idea for yourself or, you know, for a very, very small group of competent people. But in general, that's not a workable strategy. Number five, BYOD endpoint control. The net of this one is that even if you have a fairly good strategy for your organization's workstations, if people are bringing in their own devices and attaching them to your network, all sorts of craziness can ensue because you really don't have a lot of control over what version of Java is on there. And, you know, depending on the device, they may not have choices as to what version they use. So having an effective BYOD policy and I guess I'll say network access control strategy to validate the configuration of devices, whether they're BYOD or company owned or what have you, is very important. And certainly that extends well beyond the domain of just Java. Next is to review impacts on corporate websites and customer portals. And basically the thing here is maybe we ought to start moving away from Java on our websites because people are starting to get trained that Java's a bad thing, Java needs to be disabled in their browser. And if you are serving customers and they are going to your website and they don't have Java installed or they have Java disabled, they're going to have a less than stellar customer experience. So it might be time to think about moving on to something else. And then finally, number 7, if you are developing in Java, do so responsibly. And basically they mean don't self-sign or release unsigned applications. You know, you want to obtain a valid certificate to sign your applications in the same way that attackers can get valid certificates to sign their applications. We don't want malware to be signed and legitimate things to be unsigned after all. Okay, next story. Microsoft releases a statement that invulnerable software is not possible. InfoWorld has an article where they talk with some Microsoft person about their secure development lifecycle. And it's actually an interesting read, and I think most of the more responsible software development houses have adopted a software development lifecycle. And certainly I think Microsoft is probably one of the major success stories, I'll say, and I know that's somewhat heretical for me to say, but if you contrast where they're at today versus where they were at, let's say, 10 years ago, it's pretty dramatic what has happened. And a lot of that appears to be attributed to their adoption of a secure development lifecycle. Now, the net of the article is that writing code in a way that is free from defects and security vulnerabilities is simply not possible because the code is being written by people and people make mistakes. And I think it's probably pretty self-evident, but it's somewhat timely because there has been a number of discussions lately in the realm of security awareness training versus just make the darn software secure to begin with. And the point here is that, well, we don't really have any hope of making software that is totally secure. So where are we left? And that's why I wanted to bring this article up. I thought it was interesting in that context. It also says that we're all going to have jobs for quite some time to come. The next story is back to the old failed OpUSA attack by Anonymous on the US, where they were going to wipe the US off of the cyber map. And well, as we know, it didn't work out very well. But what is interesting is, and I think I mentioned it at the time, the attackers, or some of the attackers, released pretty lengthy lists of websites that were compromised as part of OpUSA. And it was kind of interesting because a lot of them were not US websites. A lot of them were .rus. There were a lot of .phs, a lot of .brs, and so on. But Trend Labs has a pretty interesting blog post, which I again have linked in the show notes, where they basically have called out these attackers as having compiled this list of attacked or hacked sites over some period of time and just dump it on the day of their quote operation. I think the last two paragraphs of the article sum it up pretty well, and I'll read it. Quote, what can users learn from this event? Primarily, it's to treat damages claimed in these sorts of campaigns with some skepticism. Based on what we saw, attackers can stockpile compromised sites and release them when a major campaign like this is conducted to make their claims of damage more impressive. For security professionals, it's a reminder that campaigns like OpUSA are not always a good indicator of when threats are likely to escalate. Preventing infection ahead of time can ensure you're not caught up when attackers flip the switch in these high-profile campaigns. End quote. And that's pretty well said, in my opinion. Okay, next story. Thousands of Akron, Ohio taxpayer files accessed by hackers. The names, social security numbers, and credit card numbers of Akron taxpayers has been compromised by some hackers. I bring up this story because it is probably a good example on what not to do after a breach. The article I linked to is from a local news organization in Akron, and it's a fairly short article, but you know, one of the great quotes in the article was, Morala said that all the firewalls were up to date, and he's perplexed as to how the hacking occurred. He said he doesn't think the city was targeted specifically. I'm just saying, if you find yourself in this kind of situation, work on a slightly better story. And the last article for tonight is from PC World, and it describes a speech given by a Trend Micro executive on the importance of malware becoming increasingly invisible. And I don't think this is particularly novel to most people, but it certainly is a good reminder that, in my view, we're seeing kind of a split, right? We're seeing malware becoming, or I should say malware whose purpose is to exfiltrate data or spy or monitor things, becoming more and more stealthy, much harder to detect. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, we're seeing malware become increasingly destructive, like what we saw in South Korea. But it's an interesting but quite short article. Well, that's all I have time for tonight. I have a busy evening yet in store for me, and a busy week coming up. So I hope everyone has a great week ahead. Again, I'm not sure if there'll be another podcast next week, but certainly the week after there will be. As far as books goes, I'm reading a really good book. I'm not very far into it, so don't take this as gospel yet, but the name of the book is Practical Malware Analysis, The Hands-On Guide to Dissecting Malicious Software. It's actually been pretty good so far. Certainly, even if you're not going to be a reverse engineer for malware, it's still, as a security practitioner, good to understand some of the inner workings of malware and be able to conceptually understand how it propagates, what it's doing, and what forensics people are doing when they're taking a look at malware. Give it a read. As usual, hit me up on Twitter at DefensiveSec. The website is www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find the show notes. You can find other cool stuff I post there. Send me an email, info@defensivesecurity.org, with your questions, comments, suggestions, criticism, whatever. I've been getting quite a few very interesting emails from different parts of the world, lots of interesting discussions. I'll probably talk about some in upcoming shows. With that, I'm going to cut it short. Have a great night. Take care, everyone. Bye.